Get ready for all the craziness of small business. It's exactly that craziness that makes it exciting and totally unbelievable. Small Business Radio is now on the air with your host, Barry Moltz.
Well, thanks for joining this week's radio show. Remember, this is your final word in small business. For those keeping track, this is now show number 511. This episode is provided by Nextiva, the all-in-one communications platform. It's also provided by Square Payroll, the easy way to pay your team. Go to www.square.com/go/SBR. It's also provided by LinkedIn, the place to advertise, to generate leads, and build relationships to your audience. Go to www.linkedin.com/SBR for a free exclusive $100 air credit. Well, I have said for a long time to small business owners that no one, and let me tell you, no one wants to buy your stuff anymore. What they want is to buy a customer experience or a customer relationship with your company. My first guest says we are in the middle of a new revolution, the convenience revolution. Shep Hyken is a customer service and experience expert and the chief amazement officer of Shepherd Presentations. He's a New York Times and Wall Street Journal best-selling author and has been inducted into the National Speakers Association Hall of Fame for lifetime achievement as a speaking professional. He's got a new book out. Again, it's called The Convenience Revolution. Shep, welcome back to the show.
Hey, man, it is so good to talk to you today, and thanks for that amazing introduction.
It's my pleasure. So let's talk about the customer service and customer experience. I don't even like to call it customer service anymore because I feel that's reactive more than proactive.
Yeah, I mean, it can be proactive with the right mindset, but you're right. Most people see customer service as a department. It's not a department. It's a philosophy. And if you look at it even bigger picture, it's part of the customer's experience. And today, you're not just measured by just how nice you are, because how nice you are doesn't matter if the product doesn't meet the expectations of the customer. Or maybe it does, but somebody else has nice service too, and the way they present the product to you is really cool and different. And then there's a third level, and you mentioned the new book, is some companies have figured out if I could just make it easier for my customer, you know, I have good service, I have a good product, but if I could be easier for my customer than my competitor, I'm going to win that business. And the experience just keeps getting better and better.
So why is easy so important now? Is it because we've been trained by a long time ago with Dell computers where you could easily assemble your custom computer, or through Amazon where you can easily order and track everything you buy?
Yeah, Amazon is one of the case studies in the book. It's actually, I devoted an entire chapter because there's 6 convenience principles. Amazon's in all of them. They have educated the consumer on what easy is. Boy, it's 2:00 in the morning. I think I want to buy something. I'll just go online and look at Amazon's choices. And you know what? I'll get it within 2 days. I don't have to leave the house to get it. Maybe it's 2 hours, depending upon, you know, where you are and what you're ordering. So they have set the bar high. And guess what? The customer doesn't compare you to direct competitors anymore. They compare you to the best service they get from anyone. And the question is, are you studying not just your competition, but the best of the best world-class service and experience companies to say, you know what, I can do that too?
I mean, I really remember when my kids were young and I was putting my son to bed, and he said, "Dad, I'm so excited about my birthday tomorrow. I hope I really get that skateboard." And of course, I tested myself. Oh, crap. I forgot it was his birthday and I forgot I want a skateboard. I go on, it wasn't Amazon at the time, it was another delivery service. I order the skateboard. It was there in 2 hours and it was underneath his bed before he woke up the next morning. Now that's convenience.
Yeah, that's exactly. And you know what? I'll bet you if there was not a price issue there.
No, right? No, that was very flexible.
Yep, exactly. And that's the point. If you're sitting in a hotel room and they've got a mini bar or a mini refrigerator in the hotel room with a can of Coca-Cola for $5, just down the hall there might be a soda machine with the same can of Coca-Cola for $1.25. You know what? What are you going to do? Well, many people get up and they go over to the refrigerator, and the next day you always see hotel employees restocking, because at certain points, price is irrelevant compared to the convenience. Now, there are points, like, and Amazon's made it so, where I can give you convenience and a good price. But even Amazon admits, hey, sometimes this isn't the lowest price. You can buy it from someone else. They put it right there underneath their price. Buy this from someone else at a lower price. And guess what happens? The customer knows. I'm so comfortable with the way Amazon handles things. They've made it so easy. I'm going to stay with Amazon.
So why do you use the word convenience, Shep? Because for a very long time, I mean, let's face it, mostly the customer experience for a lot of businesses, they paid lip service to it, but it mostly really stunk. Why has convenience as a word really risen up to what customers really want?
Well, there's a reason they call a convenience store a convenience store, because it's convenient. And that was one of the premises of where I started, you know, on this book. I go, it really is. I was going to say we're easy. What's another word for easy? Convenient. And when I did my research, I found out that, you know, the first convenience store of all time was back in 500 and something A.D. when Justinian the Great declared that there would be at every major crossroads a store selling life's necessities for the convenience of the citizens. And then it took almost another 600 years or so. I don't know how many. A long time. I'm doing my math. Almost.
I thought it was 7-Eleven that had the first convenience store
yeah,
back in 500
right.
B.C.
Right. Exactly. Well, 7-Eleven turned out to be the next convenience store, because in 1920-something, they owned ice stores where you bought blocks of ice and you put them in your refrigerator. Well, actually, it wasn't a refrigerator. It was called an ice box back
right.
then. And then somebody, his name was Uncle Johnny, that's what they called him, put some milk and bread on top of one of the blocks of ice, and the customer said, can I buy that? And he said, sure. And the convenience store was born as we know it today. And today there's 65,000 of those stores around the world, just under the brand of 7-Eleven, not to mention all the other brands that are out there. And you know what? People will go in there. It's in. It's out. They don't have the same selection as the big grocery store, but it's so much quicker. It's so much easier. It's definitely not less expensive. Not that much more, though. And that's why they call it convenience. And I started thinking about, what's a good word for it? And is it a revolution? So I use the word revolution, and you want to know why? Because my publisher said they like that word better than the convenience economy.
That's the way it goes.
Some other ideas.
That's the way it goes.
But here's what happened. About a week before the book came out, which was just this past, a month or two ago in October, a week before, a major report from a major organization came out and said convenience is the buzzword of 2019.
Because you created
the word.
Because you created.
I didn't create it.
You determine the word every year.
So I just thought to myself, well, I might be onto something now. Maybe right. I'm not wrong.
I thought it was so interesting because 7-Eleven got its name because they were open from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m., and that was the definition of convenience back then. If a store
mm-hmm.
today is only open from 7 to 11, that's not convenient. 24
nope.
hours is convenient. So things have definitely shifted. Talk a little bit about some of the convenience strategies and how I figure out whether it's right for my company.
Sure. So there's six convenience principles. I'm going to go through them. I'm going to try to do all of them in 2 minutes or less. How's that?
All right.
Not one at a time, but all of them.
Sure.
Say go when I'm ready.
Go.
Here we go. The first is simply to reduce friction, which is an element of all six, but some companies make it their whole value proposition. Uber reduces friction. You don't have to call for a cab. You can see how far away your car is. You don't even have to pay for it when you get out. It's just automatically taken care of. That's reducing friction, and look what they did to their competition. Number two is self-service. Put control into the customer's hands. It could be like, hey, if you want to book an appointment with me, right online. Here's my whole schedule. Look at it and just choose the time that's convenient for you. Or you can PayPal is technology, which is also convenient. But you can transfer money from one place to the next super fast. That's self-service. But by the way, that's also technology. Amazon is a whole technology company. They're all online, a website. So technology is another one. Reduce friction, self-service, technology. How about a subscription model? That's number four. Can you promise a customer that every month at a given time they're going to get whatever it is they need, or every 6 months or whatever? Netflix is a subscription model. You can now subscribe to a car. You don't have to own the car. You don't have to maintain it. You don't have to insure it. You subscribe to it. There's lots of different brands. I love the idea of a Porsche, although that's a very expensive subscription. But when you buy into their or subscribe to their system, you don't have one car you subscribe to. You get to choose any car you want, and you get to swap them out throughout the year. You get tired of the two-seater, go into the Sport Utility. It's amazing. Subscription. Number five is delivery. Take it to the customer. Speaking of cars, my auto dealer, whenever I need service, they bring me a brand-new loaner. It's one of their demonstrators, and I drive that for the day, and when my car is ready, they bring it back. They said the only time you come into our dealership is to buy a new car. Pretty
wow.
Cool. And then finally, access. How, you know, are you open the hours that are convenient to your customers? 7-Eleven, like you said, now it's 24 hours. But how about, you know, your customer service department? I once was trying to build something for my daughter. I bought it at a store, and like I'm putting it together, and I needed help. And I called only to find out that Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 is when their service is available. This is a consumer
right.
item. It's like, I need you after hours. Starbucks, you know, if you're in a busy city, every two blocks there's a Starbucks. Maybe every one block. Look across the street and you're at one and you can see another one. Walmart's within, in the U.S., 90% of the population is within 10 minutes of a Walmart. That's access. Back to Amazon, 24/7 they're open. Huntington Bank said, we'll stay open after hours so that people, normal people who want to go bank can come in after work rather than have to take time off or take a long lunch, and they're even open on Saturday. So those are the six principles: reducing friction, self-service, technology, subscription, delivery, and access.
So I want to talk about a couple of these things. Subscription, which I think has been the best thing for small business owners, because a lot of them worry about Shep as this one and done, right?
Yep.
I sell to you one time, and there isn't a revenue stream that goes on. And I thought it was brilliant that several years ago, you would buy an iPhone and you would pay for it, or you'd get it on a loan plan. But now you can get it on subscription. And my kids
right.
loved it because every year they could upgrade. But the little trick of that is that, yeah, you can upgrade, but you keep paying that $49 a month. So it was brilliant. That model really is great for small businesses.
And people, and by the way, the iPhone and Apple is a big business, but let's talk about a small business. Hey, I'm a customer service speaker and expert, and I go out and give keynote speeches, and we also provide training. We have trainers that go out and deliver my content. And rather than a client say, hey, how much does it cost for him to come in one time? We'll create, you know, let's create a three-year program that auto-renews at the end of each year. You can choose to continue or not, and we'll give you this, and our guy will show up once a quarter at a convenient time. We you know, make the schedules work. And that way you've budgeted it. You know you're paying once a quarter. You know, our online training, we used to have an annual licensing fee. Now we do it monthly. And we tell them, and, you know, you're going to want to renew. So we'll warn you in 90 days or 60 days before it's time for renewal. Do you want to keep going? But you know what? They're so used to paying, and they like that. And for a small business, that reoccurring revenue that's consistent, that's a beautiful thing.
It is. And the other one you mentioned was access. And I find this is really important because we want to do business anywhere, any when we want to do it, like Chris Brogan says. And one of the reasons that I left Citibank not too long ago is because their local bank was only open from 10 o'clock in the morning to 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And there's some things I had to go into the bank for, especially when
right.
things get wrong. And guess what? I couldn't get there from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. So what use was it?
Right. Huntington Bank, that was their whole model. Let's stay open till 6 at night, and then let's be open on Saturdays, too. How many banks are willing to do that? Well, Huntington did it. They stole customers. They disrupted the direct competition.
I also want to talk about self-service. Why is that becoming so popular? Why would many times people would much rather book or buy something online than talk to a live person, Shep?
Well, number one, we're being trained to do that. Think about it. When's the last time you called and made a reservation for an airline ticket? And I know you're a savvy traveler. People that aren't, well, maybe they still have that available to them, but many of us just go online. So we're being trained to do that. What happens is we find it easier and more efficient. Let's take it to something as simple as ordering a pizza. When I went to college, there was no internet. You picked up the phone and you ordered a pizza. Even if it was 11 o'clock at night, Domino's delivered it. It was great. We have a whole huge base of the business world now. The millennials are coming up and they're starting to take over as a generation. It's not a bad thing or a good thing. It is a fact, okay? And they have actually morphed because many of them, the internet was still young. There was still a lot of analog going on. There was still a lot of picking up the phone and talking to somebody. But they were trained during that time to go the other direction and go into digital. Now there's a generation behind the millennials. They're in high school and even college right now. And you know what? They won't use the phone. So ordering a pizza, I like to use the phone. There's a generation that says, I will use the phone, but I don't want to use the phone. There's another generation that says, I won't use the phone. Domino's has, if you go on their website, 10 ways, not including the phone, that you can communicate and buy and order your pizza to be delivered. 10 different ways, 10 different channels. You can use the Amazon Echo, the Google Home. You can text it, your order in. You can use the app. There's, you know, you can use a social channel. You can tweet that you want your pizza delivered. It's amazing.
It's really amazing. So, and Domino's, yeah, their app is one of the reasons why they were able to turn around their business.
Right. They were struggling. By the way, there were two reasons. Even the CEO, his exact words, I know our pizza sucks. I always liked their pizza personally, but hey, they made it even better. So they said,
at 12 o'clock at night, Shep, anything tastes good, you know?
Exactly. But you know what? Competition came along, and all of a sudden they had other pizza places that were promising good pizza. They needed to upgrade their pizza. They did that, and they also upgraded the service experience that these people, their customers, experience.
Well, Shep, I appreciate you being on the show. The title of the new book is called The Convenience Revolution, just the way that your publisher wanted it. Shep, where can people reach you?
You can go to hyken.com. That's my name, H-Y-K-E-N. It's that easy and convenient.
It's convenient. Shep, thanks so much for being back on the show.
Very great to be here. Thank you.
Coming up next, when things go wrong with a product, could it be the marketing department's fault? This is WCPT AM 820. We'll be right back. I know a lot of small business owners are confused about where to advertise online and how to actually get results. You gotta be diligent because you can lose a lot of money fast if you don't choose the right platform and the right audience. The question I always get is, should I advertise on a search engine like Google or a social media platform like LinkedIn, Facebook, or Twitter? For small business owners, LinkedIn is the place to drive brand awareness, generate leads, and build long-term, purposeful relationships that result in boosting their business. This is because effective search engine advertising should target audiences, not keywords. LinkedIn's network has more than 575 members, and their advertising gives you the ability to effectively target the right message to the right people while they're working. It has the marketing tools to help you target your customers with precision, down to their job title, company name, and industry. In fact, 4 to 5 customers who are on LinkedIn are decision makers at their company, so you're building relationships with the people that really matter. This will result in higher quality leads and more website traffic. So to redeem a $100 free LinkedIn ad credit and launch your first campaign, please use this website for listeners of Small Business Radio Show. You got to go to linkedin.com/SBR. That's linkedin.com/SBR for your free $100 ad credit. Remember that terms and conditions apply. Let me know about your results.
You've already upgraded your cell phone to a smart device, which lets you use the internet to be more productive on the go. But what about your desk phone? Nextiva. Is a smart business phone system in the cloud. With a simple setup through an internet connection, you can soon have access to your office communications wherever you are. Stay seamlessly connected with clients and stay more mobile than ever before with just one low monthly cost. Give your business more than just a basic desk phone. Visit Nextiva.com or call 800-799-0600 to learn more today. Nextiva. Simplifying your business communications.
Are you stuck? Is this the year you finally grow your business and make more money? During Barry's many years of running his own company, he had to deal with the challenges of a business that just wasn't going anywhere. It was a painful realization. His business had flatlined, and he had no idea how to breathe more life into it. It was especially difficult for Barry, since his customers were not getting the service he was so passionate about delivering. Second, he wasn't making any money. Finally, his business was sucking the life out of him. Do any of these sound familiar? Your sales won't budge in spite of your best efforts. You have few new leads for customers coming in, and existing customers are fading away. You're burned out and completely exhausted. It's no longer fun, and your family suffers as well. If you're one of the millions of small business owners facing these problems every year, Barry has the answer. Check out BarryMoltz.com/unstuck to subscribe to his 6-part video series. That's BarryMoltz, MOLTZ.com/unstuck.
Stick around to get your small business unstuck. More of Small Business Radio with Barry Moltz, now on WCPT 820, Chicago's Progressive Talk.
You know, in my years in small business, I've seen a lot of CEOs diminish the value of their marketing department. I remember in my last company, I had encouraged the CEO to hire a vice president of marketing, and he eventually did that. And after a week, I called that vice president, we'll call him Joe, to see how he was doing. They told me that after a week, he was no longer there. I then called the CEO and said, hey, what happened to Joe? He said, well, I tried to have a vice president of marketing for a week, but it didn't work out. My next guest is Denise Conkey, who's the author of a great new book. It's called All the Other Marketing Books Are Crap. She's the founder and CEO of the marketing firm House United LLC. She has directed brand development for more than 100 organizations in her 25-plus years in advertising and marketing. Denise, welcome to the show.
I am so happy to be here, Barry, and you are speaking to the choir, and I'm glad you started off with that CEO comment because, man, marketers are maligned.
Yeah, no, they certainly are. So the title of the book begs the question, why are all other marketing books crap?
Well, it's interesting because most of the marketing books that you see are all, you know, positive and case studies and big companies. But if you work in a company that's 500 people or less, I'm going to call that a small business, you can't look at like P&G case studies and get anything out of it. You're like one of, you know, the marketing department is 5 people big in a 500 person shop, and you're working to save your life. You can't relate to the other books. This book teaches you how to think through those tight spots.
So does it teach you how to think through it as the CEO or to think through it really as the head of marketing for your company?
It do kind of bash them, but I appreciate them buying the book and reading it, and they'll get a lot out of it. But really is for anybody who wants to watch their own back in a marketing department and learn how to think through marketing challenges. But the structure of how to think is really what the book is based on.
So what advice do you give those people that are reading the book?
Oh, have fun. Read it. It's funny. I really kind of wanted to be a stand-up comic or like a comedy writer. So that didn't like work out. I had to have a job. So this is my venue to actually frame things up that it's a good academic content, but it's kind of fun. So read it with your tongue firmly planted in your cheek, but know that everything that I say is true.
So how do you start to fix a marketing department or a marketing initiative that's really messed up?
Step by step. And the first thing that you have to do is watch your own back because there's a big target on it by everybody else in the organization. And there is a methodology to make people think and believe that you know more than you really do. There's a methodology for you to take control of situations. There's a methodology for you to position yourself in an organization as being omnipotent and all-powerful. And people allow you to do that. And it truly is about how to think. You know, so really, that's what the book is about. And if CEOs want to read it, more power to them.
So what
I want them to.
So what should, as the head of marketing in my company, what should I see as my role in that company, and what should some of my top goals be?
Well, it's an interesting thing because a CEO's job is to see vision and see where a path lies, and it's a head of marketing's job to get to that vision. So a head of marketing's responsibility is to strategically figure out the road And that is working in conjunction with the CEO. A lot of CEOs think their job is to manage. That's the president's job. You know, they make lousy CEOs if they're just managing. A CEO's job is vision. A marketing director's job is to get to the vision and get to that vision by way of strategy. A lot of people don't know how to do strategy. I mean, I've been doing this for a long time, and I'm going to throw a statistic out, which is my own grandma research. I'm not a grandma, but that's what they call it. About 15% of people can think strategically. 85% can't. And thinking strategically is about envisioning something that doesn't exist. So, you know, if a CMO is in an organization, they need to see which doesn't exist and create a road to get there. Make sense?
No, it does. So what my job as the vice president of marketing or the CMO is, I'm trying to take the vision of the small business owner and make and put into some kind of strategy that will sell our product or service.
Yeah. That's exactly right. But a lot of times, you know, this is a really good time to talk about it, because most people, organizations that are on a fiscal January to December are actually doing planning right now. And the way they're going to approach that challenge is to look at what you did last year and go, well, I guess we'll do that this year. And then they assign some crazy double-digit goal to that is pulled out of the air or other body parts. And you know what? It's impossible. That's the definition of crazy, is to do the same thing and expect double-digit growth. In the book, I try to tell people that it's okay not to get double-digit growth. It's okay to be realistic about budgets. It's okay to actually even throw ROI out the window, because it's way too complicated to figure out for most businesses. They're just set up for that. But I know it's like 40% marketers say that their greatest challenge is to report their ROI. Well, that's because you can't. It's impossible to do with 90% of the businesses out there. And nobody wants to say that because it's sort of heretic, but in the book I say it. It's like bury the bar. Don't think about ROI. That's not your job. Your job is to sell, create vision, and make things happen that are magical. That's your job.
So Denise, if the CEO says, okay, we'll do that, we'll make that investment in marketing, but you got to tell me what the ROI is, what's your response?
Actually, people have asked me that a lot through the years. As you know, my background is I was client side, but I was also agency side. So whenever you came up with an idea for a client, the clients, the bad ones, and again, we're talking about hundreds of clients through the years, hundreds of marketing departments, the data field from which I draw is really big. The bad ones would say, what's the ROI on that? Which is a preposterous question, because you're asking someone to predict the future, and ROI is basically a historical marker of the past. So my answer to people has always been $1 million. then they don't ask me that anymore, and then we can actually get out of the business.
So what you're saying, that you give them an answer, but it really can't relate to any kind of reality.
Yeah, because they go, I guess I was just posturing. You know, that's what's going through their head, because they realize that no one, and I'm not, you know, organizations like McDonald's or Burger King who do like FSIs, they know what the predictive ROI is on coupon when they send it out. That's because they've done it so many times in the past. They can, in effect, predict the future, but most marketing, especially today, can't do that. And most organizations don't even have the infrastructure in place in the organization to calculate performance. You know, but they're still required to come up with some ROI. And, you know, operations runs on continuous improvement. Marketing people are forced to somehow say, we sold year to year, 10% more because of what we did. And that's just unreasonable. Plus, it's old data, and marketing is a lot faster than that now.
So the successful marketing department, what should they be rated on if it's not ROI?
Well, there are lots of the successful department should be rated on strategic objectives and goals that are formulated based on multi-channel marketing. So milestone goals that someone says, okay, we're going to do X to get Y, but this is a very quick, short measure. We're going to do X to do Y, but this is another quick, short milestone measure. And then they're allowed to fail, because the question everyone should be answering is not what did I learn, but what am I learning? And you take that ongoing learning and say, we are learning that. And then that is the measurement by which the marketing department should be noted on. It's like, what have we learned? Well, we learned our customers are migrating from being 25 years old and single to 32 years old and married. Well, you've learned that. There's no ROI associated with that, but it's an important insight that changes everything about the context of your marketing. So, you know, the question is, are you learning something? That's how they should be measured. Are they learning things? What are they learning? And those kinds of updates, even if it's like a scrum, if it's every week or if it's every 2 weeks or if it's every month, should be how marketing people are evaluated. Is it like, what are you learning?
We're talking with Denise Conkey. She's the author of a book called All the Other Marketing Books Are Crap. Denise, the question I get a lot from small business owners is, what percent of my expenses should I put towards marketing?
Well, that's another question that just makes me, like, I'm kind of the adult in the room, or the first business responder, the first responder for business that comes in and says, Just stop. Don't think like that, because that doesn't make any sense. I have worked with companies that attribute 43% of their revenue to marketing, and I've worked with companies that attribute 1% of their revenue to marketing. There is no magic number. There's two ways to build a budget, and one is, what do I want to accomplish? And then you go, how much does it take to get there? The other way is, this is what I have to spend. Where can it take me? That's it. So it's not about, you know, the way most people who might be listening to this program have experienced it has been, you know, this is our budget, and we would like you to get 5% growth. And this is the same budget we had last year. Now go. I mean, somebody, you know, the adult in the room has to walk in and say, how do you expect to do that? That makes no sense. Also, the thing about it, too, is infrastructure is changing so rapidly, and how you allocate in a marketing budget your infrastructure, your search, your how well your website performs, whether stuff is stuck in your cart or not, if you have an online business, how you have your social. All that is marketing infrastructure, and if you reallocate money differently, like marketing budgets is marketing infrastructure, paid money to go attract people to come to your business versus the kind of stuff you kind of have to just have these days, that'll change that number for you. So that's kind of an important variable, because most people are still putting that are infrastructure-based into marketing budget, and that's the equivalent of, like, saying business cards are a part of our marketing. Well, yeah, everybody's got to have them, and you got to have a website, too. So it's a hard question to answer. There's no easy answer.
Yeah, I find that the reason that people ask is, most of the time they don't spend too much, Denise, they spend too little.
Yes, they do. And nobody has ever said, you know, I have enough money for that. I've never heard that, you know, and agencies, for instance, used to work with all sorts of budgets, but a lot of people also assume I do this a lot. Like, clients will hold their budget secret and not tell the agency, like it's like they're playing poker or some such, and say, well, how much would it cost to do that? It's like, just tell me your budget. Just tell me what you got. Because the answer that I give you on what will we do for that may change if your budget is $10 versus $15 versus $20. I mean, theoretically. All of those might have completely different strategies because the dollar amount dictates the strategy and it dictates the eventual performance. So, yeah, it's all, you know, people really want, like, you know, use 5%, use 10%. People want really easy answers. And to do it right, it's all custom.
We all want easy answers. The title of the book is All the Other Marketing Books Are Crap. If you want some answers that are not so easy, go buy a copy of the book. Denise, where can people get in touch with you?
Smartcrap.com, or they can buy the book on Amazon.
Denise, thanks so much for being on the show. Coming up, can a CRM work if you are a retailer and don't get personal information from your customers? This is WCPT 820 AM Chicago. We'll be right back. Whenever I talk to a small business owner, I insist on one function they should always outsource, and that's payroll. You see, payroll is complicated, and both the employee and the government insist that you get it right. You see, when you do payroll, not only do you have to deduct money from the employee's paychecks to remit to the government, but as an employer, you need to add to it. Plus, you need to send this money to various government agencies on a regular basis, and if you don't do it, they will hold you personally liable for it. So this is one thing you gotta stop worrying about. That's why I recommend the new Square Payroll app. With this app, you can do everything from setting up an account to paying your team. It's fully integrated with Square payments and time cards for W-2 employees and contractors. Square takes care of your tax withholdings, payments, and filings at no extra cost. There is flexible and transparent pricing that scales with your business. So go ahead, search Square Payroll in the Apple iTunes or Google Play app stores to download this app, or visit www.square.com/go/SBR to learn more.
With Barry's 25 years in small business, he has finally discovered the magic formula to make more profit at any company. Business gurus make it seem so complicated, but it is really simple. The formula is P times P equals P, where people multiplied by process means more profit. Learn how you can take a quantum leap in just 180 days to grow the profit in your business. Contact Barry at Maltz.com.
Thinking of starting your own business? Get on board for a crazy ride. Be the first to tweet Barry at Barry Maltz and get a free copy of his book, You Need to Be a Little Crazy, The Truth About Starting and Growing Your Own Business.
Stick around to get your small business unstuck. More of Small Business Radio with Barry Maltz, now on WCPT 820, Chicago's Progressive Talk.
Well, I'm a big supporter of CRM tools, customer relationship management, because I believe that small businesses need to keep track of all their contacts with customers. But unfortunately, for a lot of, especially retail consumer businesses, the traditional CRM doesn't work since they never capture anything beyond their name and credit card number until now. Toby Scammo founded Womply in 2011 after seeing firsthand how technology underserved America's small businesses. Under Toby's leadership, Womply has acquired more than 150,000 paying small business customers, becoming the leading software partner to America's credit card processing industry, has raised $50 million in growth funding, and expanded to hundreds of employees across California and Utah. Toby, welcome to the show.
Hey, Barry. Great to be here.
So why don't traditional CRMs work for these kinds of retail businesses?
So I think the fundamental issue that offline brick-and-mortar businesses have is they just can't get customer data. So if you take your favorite restaurant or store that you go to, you'll typically find that those businesses are not collecting information about their customers when they come in the store. And as a result, they don't know who their customers are and they can't reach them. And you can't build a CRM if you don't know who your customers are.
So are they not collecting it because in the process of the transaction, it's just not practical to say, hey, can you give me your email address?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, obviously, big retailers do that quite frequently. If you think of the Gap or your favorite pharmacy, they may be collecting more information about their customers. But your typical mom and pop local business, they just don't have the opportunity to do that. And as a result, they don't know who their customers are and they can't contact them once they leave the store.
It also feels like it intrudes with the transaction, right? It's not a natural part of it.
Yeah, it's just not part of the payment culture that we come to expect when we're checking out at a restaurant. If you were to hand over your credit card and then have the restaurant owner say, hey, I'm not going to process that charge unless you give me your contact information, most customers would flee that restaurant pretty quickly. And so it's a fundamental issue that's not easy for the small business owners to get past.
So before Womply, what did small businesses do? Did they just give up on it?
So I think they try to piece it together. If you think of your local business these days, they may have an email marketing account, a newsletter, a loyalty program. These are all ways in which the business owner wants to try to collect as much information about their customers, particularly their best customers. But the challenge there is that only a fraction of your customers will ever sign up for one of those programs. And in many cases, it adds cost to the business to try to ask customers to sign up or to reward customers to sign up. And so the result is that ultimately business owners just don't know who their customers are, and they have no way of reaching them once they've left their store.
So how does Womply really solve this problem?
So it took us a number of years to realize that this problem existed. Internally, we call this the zero data problem, which is it doesn't matter how good the software is that you give to a business owner. If they don't have the data or they can't easily get the data to power that software, then there's really no value in the software. So what we did was we spent 5 years building partnerships and collecting as much data as possible on behalf of small business owners. So I'll give you one example. We built a database of 200 million consumers across the U.S., and we have visibility into their transactions at millions of businesses nationwide. And we use that information to pre-populate our software so that small businesses, when they sign up, they see who their customers are that have been transacting with their business, and then they have the ability to reach out to those customers over time. So in short, we got the data first, and then we built the software second.
And so what is the data based on? So I have to be a business that collects credit card numbers from my customer. That's the way the transaction has to be done?
You just have to use credit cards as your primary form of payment. So if you're a restaurant or a retailer or a health and beauty business, you're likely using credit cards already. It probably represents the majority of your revenue. And we're working with large financial institutions to collect as much of that data as possible and then put it to work for small businesses. So many of our credit card processing partners and bank partners already have an extraordinary amount of data. They just haven't been using it to the benefit of their small businesses. And so that's what we're doing, which is really liberating this information and making it easy for small business owners to get full value from that information.
I love what you said, Toby. And this is why I was so interested in interviewing you, is because you said that if you don't have the data, then you could have the most sophisticated CRM software, marketing automation, and it's not going to help you at all because it's garbage in, garbage out. And I also found that many times people inside a company don't collect the appropriate data consistently in order to make the CRM system work.
Yeah, I think that's a problem with all CRM software and all companies, even companies like Womply. We've got 150 salespeople and customer success people in our Utah office, and we're constantly trying to collect high-quality data through our CRM to understand small businesses across the U.S. And even there, we run into problems, even with multiple managers, people that are dedicated to this problem. We've got a lot more resources we can put against that sort of problem, and obviously, small business owners, they're very unlikely to have a CRM manager or two or three operations managers that can help improve data collection. It's just not a reasonable expectation for your local business. So in many ways, we are performing that function for them. We're doing all of the data collection. We're doing the data validation. We've got a lot of sophisticated technology that we can apply to the benefit of small business owners. So they don't just get our data and our software, but they're also getting our team and all of their smarts and effort, which goes to help those small businesses across the U.S.
So, Toby, tell us a little about how it actually works when you use Womply. So I have a transaction with a customer. I get their credit card number, and obviously I get their name. What happens next?
So if you were to look in the Wamply software, you would see the result of that transaction. You would see my name if I had just transacted at your business. You'd have the ability to add additional information that you know about me as a customer. But you'd have my full transaction history at your business. And so you'd be able to see that Toby has spent here 5 times. His last visit was 2 weeks ago. And if for some reason I stopped coming to your business, we would be able to detect that through Wamply's data system and then automatically help engage me as a customer to get me back in the door. And so we could do that through email marketing or other communication methods. But really, we're trying to automate the entire customer engagement experience and ensure that small business owners don't have to spend a ton of time collecting that data, managing it, and then taking actions on every single little data point. We can do all of that for them in software.
So through Wamply, how do you get the email address or the phone number, if that's what you want, for your CRM?
Yeah, that's a great question. So small businesses, we have 150,000 small businesses across the U.S., and what they're doing is adding in all of the email addresses for their customers that have already opted in for their marketing. We also have a large pool of data that we get from other sources where consumers have opted in for marketing emails to receive emails from any business that has access to their email address. So what we do is we're putting together the consumer profile with the consumer's transaction information, with the contact info, and then we're making that available to any small business through our software anytime that customer transacts at their business. The net effect is customer comes in, they swipe their credit card. Now the business knows who they are. They can see their transactions and they can contact them through our platform.
And so because the customers have opted in on other platforms to give their marketing, their email ID, you can attach that to this new record.
Yep, exactly. And we do that in a privacy safe manner so that the small business owners themselves don't have access to the underlying email address. We're not revealing the email addresses of these consumers to the business owners, but we are allowing the business owners to send messages to those customers through our platform. And then, of course, we do a ton of work on the email management side as well to ensure that any emails being sent to these consumers are compliant with all of the laws that would apply to small businesses. And the consumers have a lot of settings that they can use to opt in or opt out of email communications from any businesses, depending on what level of communication they'd like from those businesses. So we're trying to ensure that small business owners stay within the lines of all of the email marketing regulations, including things like canned spam, and doing as much work as we possibly can on behalf of those small business owners.
And I want to reiterate something you just said, is that they get access, or they're able to send an email to those customers, but they don't get access to their exact email, so there's less of a chance for abuse.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, we've got so much data in our system, consumer profiles for a couple hundred million Americans, tens of millions of email addresses connected to these customer profiles, that we need to ensure that we're balancing and minimizing the opportunity for risk by small businesses. We don't want to put the small business owner in a position where they might do something inadvertently, send too many messages to one email address, for example, and as a result, frustrate that customer, where the small business owner may have the best intentions, but the result would be negative for their business. So we've got a few gates in place to ensure that the small business owners don't misuse our software. And as a result, we think it creates a really solid foundation that's good for business owners and also good for their customers.
So what does it take from a small business owner standpoint? What type of financial investment do they have to make in order to implement Wamply?
So that's actually the great thing about Wamply software. There's no hardware changes required. There's nothing to install. There's no point of sale system update that's necessary. We're getting data from the credit card processing networks. And so that makes it a really easy and fast installation. So business owners can sign up at Wamply.com, and within 60 seconds, they can get access to their customer data, and they can start communicating with those customers through our platform. In terms of costs, we charge a software fee for our services. Most businesses will end up paying a couple hundred bucks a month for Wamply software. And so if they're a growing business or they care about the relationships that they're building with their customers, it very easily pays for itself.
And who is the perfect customer for the Wamply solution?
So we've built the business and our software to serve any brick-and-mortar business out there that serves consumers and also accepts credit cards. So any Main Street business category, whether it's a restaurant, your local retailers, health and beauty, hospitality, auto service, auto body. We serve 400 plus business categories. We've got paying customers in pretty much every zip code in America. So we really do have a wide and diverse base of customers. I think our customer base is probably really similar to a software product such as QuickBooks or another accounting platform, in the sense that we are meeting a ubiquitous need across the marketplace. Every business should know who their customers are and should be able to engage those customers once they've left their premises. And that's really the problem that we're solving, which is a problem that applies to most businesses out there.
And I love the problem you're solving, because most CRMs solve a problem of process. You're solving that, but you're also solving the data problem.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think most CRMs are very focused on prospect and lead management and working those leads through a sales funnel and ensuring that tasks get managed by sales teams. None of those things really make a lot of sense if you're a restaurant or a retailer where you've got cashiers and servers that are interacting with your customers on a daily basis. So really, we've built our CRM platform from the ground up to serve this specific market. So any business that is interacting with lots of consumers on a daily basis that doesn't really have a sales team, they've just got people who are handling transactions and serving customers in store, those are the sorts of businesses that will get the most value from Wobbly CRM.
So, Toby, I appreciate you being on the show. Where can people learn more about Wobbly and what you're doing, especially if it might be a great solution for their small business?
So any business can sign up for Wobbly.com, W-O-M-P-L-Y.com. We can help you understand your customers and engage with them automatically through our software. We'd be happy to show you a demo. So we can give businesses a very fast path and get them value in seconds.
Toby, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Barry. Appreciate it.
And I want to thank everyone for joining this week's radio show. I want to thank our sponsors, Nextiva, the all-in-one communications platform. I want to thank Square Payroll, the easiest way to pay your team. Go to www.square.com/go/SBR. And I want to thank LinkedIn, the place to advertise, to generate leads and build relationships with your audience. If you want a free $100 credit exclusive for listeners of this radio show, you go to www.linkedin.com/SBR. I want to thank our booking producer, Sarah Shaffrin, our in-studio producer, Lady B, our marketing manager, Courtney Gilchrist. If you are serious about being more successful this year, you got to give me a call, 773-837-8250, or email me at barry@moltz.com. Isn't this the year that you get your small business unstuck? And finally, after all this time, you make the money you deserve. Remember, love everyone, trust a few, and paddle your own canoe. Have a profitable and passionate week.
You can find Barry Moltz on the web at barrymoltz.com, or more episodes of Small Business Radio at smallbizradioshow.com.